you listen to this show, there's one thing you've probably heard me say relatively often, and that's that I believe that all stories about money are really stories about choices. Money can empower us or limit us. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend. And this week, we're devoting the show to some of our favorite individual stories from all over the country. Stories about choices people have had to make, ways we've adapted, and what we've learned. We're also focused on incorporating your stories into the show, so come visit our website, marketplaceweekend.org, the Marketplace Facebook page, or reach out on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We're going to start with a story that will sound familiar to so many people on the other side of the recession. Lots of us now have work histories filled with gaps. I have one. Bill Marshall does too. It began last July when he was laid off from his job at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Marshall spoke to us from his home in Devon, Pennsylvania. He says he's learned a lot from his gap, but he really hates one dreaded question.
What do you do? I have nothing to say to that. It feels, it feels bad and isolating in a lot of ways, and I just don't feel like I'm as much of a part of everything, even if that everything is just complaining about work, getting to and from work, having to wake up early because of work, and getting paid too little for work. What do you do? You hope you can say you're starting your own venture or you're starting your own business. You're not going to say, I'm unemployed and living off my savings. Doesn't really impress people. I go to family gatherings and I don't really enjoy them because I always think everyone's talking about me behind my back. I always used to sneer when higher-ups at work would talk about how much like a family the organization I worked in was. But now that I'm not there anymore, I realize that it's sort of true, but it's kind of like a family in which everyone forgets about you if you move away. You do feel adrift. And in the first few weeks after my job ended, I'd tell people how I'd go a whole day without talking to anyone, and they'd say, wow. Sometimes when I do talk to people at grocery stores, I have to clear my throat before it, and I'll go home and I'll think about how I had a conversation, but then I realize that the only thing I said was, that's okay, I brought my own bag. Sometimes you spend more money when you're unemployed than you do when you're working. You have more time to buy things for your house, and you're sitting in your house or apartment all the time, and you see things that you think of replacing now that you're looking at them all day, like a throw rug or a new shower curtain. And you also forget the connection between your money and the work you did to get it, because you're not thinking about how that bad movie just cost you an hour's worth of work. It just cost you 15 bucks or whatever. Well, now money just has meaning because you need it, of course, but when it comes to actual cash, you just don't think about it. They're just sort of like these coupons you're giving people. And this is the first time I've been eligible for unemployment compensation, so I've been living on that. It's not a lot, but I have a lot of savings and nobody to support. I have managed to save enough money that I'm not yet desperate. The good things? I get plenty of sleep, which I know some people would put that in the bad column, but I do feel rested and healthy. There is age bias, whether people admit it or not. I don't want to train this guy if he's just going to get old and retire. What do you do? I have nothing to say to that.
That was Bill Marshall from Devon, Pennsylvania. You heard a story about being out of work. Now we've got one about how special technology can help people find work. Professor Albert Rizzo, known as Skip, is a pioneer in virtual technology. His program is the Virtual Interactive Training Agent, or VITA. It aims to help people do something that a lot of us take for granted, navigate a job interview. For people on the autism spectrum, job interviews can be particularly daunting. So VITA helps them practice with a virtual interviewer, Here's Skip Rizzo to explain with a little help from his creation.
The Vocational Interview Training Agents is actually an application that uses artificially intelligent virtual human technology.
How are you?
VITA for short. The agents are actually mock interviewers. They're job interviewers that give a person an opportunity to practice job interview answers and responses and skills and getting comfortable and so forth.
I'm glad you're here. In a minute, we'll get into some questions about the job. But before we do, why don't you just tell me about yourself?
I'm a clinical psychologist, and I direct the Medical Virtual Reality Research Group at the University of Southern California Institute for Creative Technologies.
That was a good answer.
With these characters, we've built six of them, and they're of all ages and gender, ethnic background. We can set them to have three different behavioral dispositions. They can be really that nice light touch job interviewer.
Fantastic. Again, thank you so much for coming in and meeting with me.
Or the neutral interviewer, or the...
The fact is, you're going to make a mistake. There's no way around it. So why don't you tell me, what's the worst mistake you've ever made?
The real stress interviewer, the real son of a bee. And we can have people practice how they will respond to these types of characters under a range of conditions. So it really gives people experiential practice in how to do a job interview. And when they're done with, say, a 10-15 minute interview, they can review what they've said. They can see a split screen of the reviewer or the interviewer and themselves and, get a little bit of insight into their behavior and sitting with a voc counselor.
That's a pretty good strength. Now, everyone has something they would like to change or improve. So what about yourself would you like to improve?
They can possibly improve their skills. There's a lot of folks out there that can do the job, that have the skills, but they choke during an interview, and particularly people with special needs. And that's where we've really targeted this work.
Maybe you haven't thought this far ahead, and that's okay. But have you set any career goals for yourself? If so, can you tell me about some of them?
We originally started the project working with the Dan Marino Foundation to target high-functioning people on the autistic spectrum. And these are people that are oftentimes quite intelligent, but they have difficulty in social situations. And so for them, going through a job interview is a trial by fire. I mean, even more so than for the rest of us. And one of the advantages here is that, you know, everybody knows that these are not real people that are interviewing them. So there's no risk. They can goof up a bunch, and they don't have to worry about impression management. They don't have to worry that somebody's going to think they're, you know, a fool or, you know, they don't have, there's no shame. You can mess up a bunch in your job interview and get over those mistakes, get more comfortable with the process, and hence, hopefully not make the same mistakes when you're actually in the real thing.
Well, it was a pleasure speaking with you, and I'll be in touch when we've made our decision.
So, does VITA actually help people on the spectrum prepare for interviews? For Aaron Brown Coates, it made a difference. He went through the program at the Dan Marino Foundation. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So, tell me what it's like to do an interview with VITA.
It was honestly very... You know, I'm sure it's very surreal for people that have never done it before, but for me, as someone who has a background in the video game industry and things like that, you know, it was very comforting. It's very not as intimidating as a real interview because there's that disconnect there that allows you to really focus on what you're doing and not focus on how the other person is perceiving you.
Do you feel like it helped you get ready for job interviews?
It did. It's actually very, I think it was perfect training. I think it's way better than a mock interview, especially to be supplemented with actual mock interviews. I think it's a perfect way of training for interviews.
Before you started learning this stuff, what did you think about job interviews or maybe just kind of interacting with people when you were being an intern? What was that like for you?
Before, it was pretty intimidating. I've always had an issue actually like keeping eye contact with people or making sure that I don't feel intimidated, making sure my words come out very, you know, eloquently, make sure they come out very easy to understand. And the VITA honestly did help with focusing my thoughts. It had allowed me to concentrate more on myself and concentrate more on what's important for what I say and less on, oh, is this person going to hire me? Oh, is this person, like, does he like me? Oh, am I too nervous? Am I too this? Am I too that?
And tell me what you're doing now at work.
Well, what I do at work is I pretty much am a subcontractor. I help companies with their social media profiles. I help them post things and things like that.
Either at work or in life, what do you think people don't understand about you?
Well, as someone who's on the autism spectrum, I'm Asperger's. People feel like maybe I'm very, very socially awkward and things like that. And while I may be, to a certain degree, very socially awkward, it's mostly that those skills don't come very naturally to me. Those skills, I definitely possess those skills. It's just that I have to train myself more than the average person to present myself socially, present myself confidently.
Well, Aaron Brown Coates, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. One of the enduring legacies of the financial crisis and the recession that followed is that the people who grew up during it, millennials, have a relationship with money that's very different from that of other generations. Many have a lot of student debt. They're cautious about investing or buying homes, making big purchases. Writer Sarah Merck was nervous about buying anything big. It even took her ages to commit to what she bought in our next story.
The biggest thing I own is my mattress. Some people have trucks or boats or houses or heirloom chests of drawers or ambitiously large desks or ill-conceived contemporary art pieces. But the most impressive thing I own is just this big, squishy rectangle. It might not seem like much, but getting this mattress was a major life step for me. When I first moved to Portland, Oregon 6 years ago, I was determined to furnish my room only through things I could get for free. This sounds like a bohemian ideal, but factoring into my ethics was the fact that I was dang near broke. The truth, though, is that even when I got a job, soon after Obama was inaugurated, I was scared to buy anything remotely nice, like a blender or a sofa that didn't smell like cats. So when a roommate offered me his old futon frame and pad from the basement, claiming it was like sleeping on a cloud, I gladly took him up on the offer. That futon turned out to be a cloud made of stabby wooden railroad slats. But it was my accursed futon now, and I was grateful. I know I'm supposed to view large, expensive items as investments. I feel like I'm supposed to go into debt for things because they'll wind up helping me in the long run. But I came of age in a time when the absurdity of the whole credit system became tragically clear. The people running the economy reminded me of Gene Wilder's version of Willy Wonka, mysterious men running around, gleefully pulling levers that unleashed sweet rewards on some and chaos on others. When I was a kid, I remember debt stalking my parents like a silent, gloomy cloud. The day they finally paid off their credit cards, they cut them up in front of me, and we ordered pizza to celebrate. Years later, I spent a week helping tear down sodden houses in Mobile, Alabama, after Hurricane Katrina tore through and flooded whole neighborhoods. I spent days shoveling people's possessions into giant piles in the gutter. Carpets, entire moldy bookshelves, waterlogged TVs. All signs seemed to point to the conclusion that big possessions, requiring a mortgage and a car payment and a cable bill, would become an anchor, dragging me underwater. I realized, slowly, that I'm not a bohemian free spirit. I'm a frugal cynic. Back on that horrible slab of a futon, I toughed out the nights for 2 years, until my very sweet new boyfriend finally cracked. He told me in no uncertain terms that I either needed to get an actual mattress or he was never sleeping at my house again. But I protested, I can't just buy a mattress. Yet he had a point. So I dutifully went to IKEA on the bus and walked up the trail to the bedroom section, to the gauntlet of modernist bed frames, eyeballing prices. Around me, cheerful couples were buying mattresses, joyfully betting on a stable future full of new furniture and reliable middle-class jobs. That's the IKEA spirit. I felt so out of place that I turned heel and left in defeat. After another night, gathering my resolve while lying on the wooden planks, I gave it another shot, heading to a family-run mattress store near my house. It was empty when I walked in. Without the oppressively upbeat surroundings, I actually liked looking at the beds. I flopped on one after another. They were so comfy. It dawned on me that a bed was not a dangerous luxury item that would trap me. This was a bed. Come bull market or bailout, you need a bed. It's okay to buy something that I'll appreciate for years and years, I realized, even if I don't know what those years will look like. I paid $300 for a springy queen-size mattress, and I felt good. I've had that mattress for 4 years now. At the end of each chaotic day, it's nice to come home to a stable and cozy place. And besides, worst case scenario, it can always double as a life raft.
Sarah Merck is the author of Sex from Scratch. Now, someone who had a pretty rough beginning in the world. Javier Chavez was only 11 when he got involved with a gang in L.A. He's been arrested multiple times on charges ranging from selling drugs to weapons possession. His longest stint in prison was 4 years. Javier is now in his 30s, and he says he's getting a second chance at life.
I lost a lot of years, man, off and on. It wasn't like a long stretch period, but it was like periods of time, 5 years here, 4 years here, 3 years here, violation here of a year, a few months in the county here and there, you know. And aside from that, my life of addiction, 23 years, and when drug addiction took over, I just lost control of my life. It's been 3 years since the last time I was incarcerated. I got caught with 38 balloons of heroin, and I was facing some time, and I was just kind of like looking at it like, here we go again, kind of like the merry-go-round. You jump on one horse and it's still only going around. So it was just, I'll jump from one horse to the next one, and everything was still going around. I was just going in circles. And I remember being in the county, in the LA County Jail, and I looked around and I asked myself, is this it? Everything I've done my whole life, from doing crimes, getting high, robbing, stealing, is this it? Is this the grand price? You know, being in a cell block with another man, spending the rest of my life right there, or just sitting down in a cage. And it was a turnaround point, man. You know, but I think I just want to have, like, people understand that we're all human. We all go through things. I call this a second chance at life, man. I got my own place. I pay rent. I used to think I was dumb because I dropped out, right? But when I got that GED, like, it pumped me up to look at myself and be like, you know what? Man, I could do big things, man, in life, you know? Once I got to that point where I changed, great things started happening for me, you know?
That was Javier Chavez. These days, he's a supervisor and mentor at Homeboy Industries, an LA program that works with at-risk youth. This week, we're telling personal stories through the lens of money, a fitting theme for our next story about a naturalist who lives way up in the mountains of Boone, North Carolina. Eustace Conway has been living in the forest there for nearly 40 years.
My birthday gave me the point where I was like, well, I'm 17 now. I can go out on my own. You know, I'm old enough now. And so that's the day I walked out into the forest and started living in a teepee and being hungry and touching reality. Well, at that time, I didn't need any money. It wasn't anything to do with the money. You could wipe your ass or blow your nose or start a fire. That's about all good for. Out here in this forest with this lifestyle, other than like paying land taxes, if you just take it down to living, money is meaningless. It's nothing. It is not even a concern, not even a thought. It's no good. You could have piles of it. Doesn't do anything. You could drop me anywhere in the world, and even if it was a desert or a beach somewhere that I wasn't even familiar, I could survive fairly well, and it's because I carry with me knowledge in my head, you know, and it's something that you can't lose. It doesn't matter if it gets rained on, it's not going to fade. It's something that's inside of my hands and my brain. It's an ability, knowledge of how to interact with the world, to make and fix anything that I need. And that's a real insurance policy, and that's real peace. You know, like I know that I can deal with it, whatever. Life doesn't have to cost you a bunch. You know, it doesn't have to cost hardly anything. I'm certainly not worried. I have started thinking about it now that I'm getting closer to old age. My hair is white, you know, and I'm thinking about it, but not worried. Basically, my skills can help me manifest whatever I need out in this forest environment. Here's the bottom line. If I get old and die, I don't care. I'll just rot back into the ground. It suits me fine to feed one of the trees that's been helping me. You know, I'm a part of the forest, and if I melt back into it, that's okay. I've succeeded at everything that I've gone about, maybe other than finding a wife that suits me for a lifelong companion, but like I wouldn't want to change my way of living for anything.
That was Eustace Conway of Boone, North Carolina. Eustace Conway leads a pretty non-traditional life, but so does the next person you'll hear from. She's a singer-songwriter. Songwriting and financial security are not the kind of things that generally go hand in hand. Here, Amy Spies talks about how hard it is to make ends meet through her music.
We're head over heels, in over our head. We borrow and steal to pay the rent. Gonna save any money that's already spent.
We borrow and steal to pay the rent. How are we gonna save any money when it's already spent? I think this chorus is just the truth of it, just came out because it's the truth. Hi, I'm Amy Spies, and I'm sitting in my living room in East Nashville, Tennessee. I'm both a singer and a songwriter. It's a great life, but not a great living, I'll be honest about that. So I wrote this song called Spent that is just about the challenges that you have when you try to buy your first house with, you know, credit checks and things like that, and having the kind of the dream of buying a house even as a songwriter or any kind of a creative artist. I picture a couple standing on the back porch of a house that they are renting that they realize that they might not be able to afford. You know, a year ago, I was in a position where I was renting a house and I was offered a chance to buy it. And I knew that I was able to buy it at a little bit lower than what the market value of that house would be. And I really wanted to buy it. And I'm in my 40s and I've been an artist my whole life since I got out of college. But because I'm an artist, I hadn't really saved money thinking of a down payment on a house. I'd actually kind of given up hope that I'd ever be able to buy a house because I was living in New York City. When I moved to Nashville, I realized that these houses were semi-affordable, and I had friends who were artists who were able to buy houses. So I started walking through the process of it, and it was a little frustrating to find out that my credit that I thought was actually fine was not fine enough for me to be able to get a mortgage at a good rate. It brought up a lot of fear for me, being the age I'm at. I'm also single. I definitely would never choose. I would never change what I've chosen to do. I just hope that there's a way for me to be able to have the same things that other people who are in the middle class have.
That's singer-songwriter Amy Spies. And there's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead.
A dream we could have and hold. Something of our own. A place to call home.
We've talked on this show about the big multi-million dollar efforts in cities across the country to combat homelessness. New York, LA, Portland. But we wanted to bring you a personal story about what being homeless feels like. Darlene Bell Grayson is an actor who moved from New York to Los Angeles, couldn't find enough work to pay the bills, and found herself without a place to live for the first time in her life.
I'm homeless. I really am homeless. Homeless. But I'm not the homeless person that you see and you think is homeless. I'm not on the street. I'm not dirty. I'm not raving and needing medication. I'm not the typical face of a homeless person, but I actually am. And I don't know where I'm going to go, and I don't know what I'm going to do. It just never crossed my mind that I would ever be in a place of being without, because I had saved so much. I lived on very little when I was doing a Broadway show, and I always had it in my mind, I want to be able to make it through the lean times. So I learned from my parents budgeting very well, and my mom is really, really good with that. And so here I am. It's now June of 2012. I have no unemployment. I have no job. I have no prospects. I have no rent. I don't have family with the resources that can jump in and help me. I was just at a loss for words. And it's not because I did anything. I'm doing everything that I know to do to find work. And I'm pursuing work in avenues that I wouldn't ordinarily even go to, that I'm just trying to take care of myself and nothing's happening. When I say nothing, I had nothing. I mean, I don't have rent. I don't have food. I had nothing. And then I got very sick out of nowhere. I got a job, And then I wasn't able to start the job because then I got shingles. So now I'm contagious to some people that haven't had chicken pox. I can't look for work for a month. I got behind on my rent. I have never missed my rent in my adult life. And at that point, I had been on my own for 20 years, a little over 20 years. I've never been late for my rent. And I've got friends, but I didn't have friends that were in a position to do a whole lot. There had been another person that I didn't know really that well, but had heard that I was in a very tough time and opened her home to me. And I thought, I'll be here a maximum of 2 months. 8 months later, when I moved, but I was living on her couch for 8 months. It allowed me to, first of all, find a job, be able to save money, to get back on my feet. But the question that was always in my mind was, how did I get here? How did I become homeless? What decisions did I make on the way that led to this? I would ask other people that knew me well enough that would have an unbiased eye, and they're just as mystified. You don't realize that you look down on others that are in a hard time. It's just, it must be that they did this, this, and this. I didn't do any of those things, but life still happened to me. I never thought that I would actually say this. I wouldn't have changed it. I don't regret having gone through it. I will grow from it, but I wouldn't change it.
Darlene Bell Grayson spoke to us in Los Angeles. Everybody has one, a story or a moment when money changes your life. And that's what we're doing this week, examining those moments and the effects they have on us. Writer Brian Finkelstein tells us about a time when everything was going great, and then the bubble burst.
The first time I made a lot of money, I was in my 20s, and I was broke. I was that broke in your 20s where you have sleep, you know, for dinner. You know, that feeling where you're like, oh, it's 8 o'clock, and I'm just going to go to bed because I have no money. And that's the way I lived my life. I was living in Brooklyn. I moved there because there was an art scene. I didn't paint or have any sort of artistic desires, but I wanted to be part of that community, so I moved there. I was living in Williamsburg, and I just would go to different jobs all the time, different places, make a few dollars an hour, and then leave, and then go on to the next one. And I got a job at this place, Kiehl's, which is a skincare store in the East Village in Manhattan, and I didn't know what it was. I'm not the type of person who uses skincare. And I got hired for $8 an hour to be the doorman. And that I could do. I went to Queens College, so I had enough education to say hello and goodbye. And I was doing that. I was making $8 an hour. And after like 6 months, I told the manager, Cammy, who kind of looked like a human Barbie doll, that I quit. I get a call at my house from this woman, Jamie Van Heidegger Morse, who owned Kiehl's. And she told me to stay, that she wanted me to train people on skincare. And I was like, no, that's not for me. I'm a schlubby, white, straight dude. And I worked in a place with fabulous, beautiful women and gay men, and they sold skincare. I couldn't. No one would want to buy it for me. I was not a poster for a good living. And she's like, no, but you represent a certain demographic that we don't have, and well, we really want you. Now, I was making $8 an hour, I was living hand to mouth, and she goes, here's what your salary will be if you start working, if you train at Kiehl's. We will pay you $90,000 a year, plus commissions, which came to over $100,000 a year. She gave me her American Express Black Card to go shopping in Soho and buy myself fabulous clothes, her words, a gym membership to Equinox, and then benefits along the way, including a 401k. And that was the first time in my life that I made a lot of money. And that just sort of changes the way you feel about things at that point, because then the art idea just went away. Like any sort of integrity I had was bought that night and that phone call for the rest of my life. I worked at that job for 7 years, and it was great, and I made a lot of money, got myself out of debt, I paid my friends rent, I was the guy in that group of artists that had money, and, you know, I lived in Williamsburg, and I worked in East Village, and both places were still cool and independent and mom and pop. And Keel's was this independent place that had been owned since the 1800s by this guy, John Keel and Irving Morris and this family. And it was very independent and it was like an apothecary and it was very New York. But then one day we held this meeting and she told us that L'Oreal had bought it. Which was just like the worst, because L'Oreal, like in the cosmetics slash skincare industry, that's like there's L'Oreal and Lancome and they own everything. You know, there's only 30 of us that made this multi-million dollar company grow. And when L'Oreal took over, they loved the brand of it. And then they did everything they can to change it. Because, of course, they were not going to pay people that much. So they just fired all of us. And slowly, as I looked around, there was, you know, Union Square was this beautiful place where there was very independent, like, restaurants and stuff. And then the L'Orealization of New York happened. You know, there was two Starbucks, a Toys R Us, a Barnes & Noble, a Virgin Megastore. And it just happened overnight one day where it was all over. So I just spent all the money I had over the next 5 years pursuing a job as a comedian and a writer, and I started doing a lot of shows, and then eventually moved to Los Angeles.
Brian Finkelstein is a comedian and performer in Los Angeles. We just heard a story about financial highs and lows, and now the internet has made making money just that much faster. And in the case of our next story, made it a lot easier to do from home. If you look at something like artisanal soap making, yes, this is public radio, it's grown from just a few producers in the mid-1980s to over 150 today. Same idea with candle makers, quilters, and cross-stitchers, because of places like Etsy and Kickstarter. So how good is the internet for handmade goods? Jody Rice is a cross-stitch designer. She's got a shop on Etsy, and cross-stitching is her full-time job.
Most of my friends can't believe I do it, and they can't believe I make enough money at it to support myself, because they can't believe that I've managed to quit the normal 9-to-5 life. Right now, we're in my home office, which is the second bedroom in my apartment. I am a cross-stitch designer, and I have a shop on Etsy called Satsuma Street. It's like a cool version of what your grandmother would have done 30 years ago, 40 years ago. That's what my grandmother did, was cross-stitch and needlework and needlepoint. And now with the internet, there's the possibility for people like me to provide designs for little niche groups of people who want something different than what these big giant companies thought. Oh, well, everybody who does cross-stitch wants to do cross-stitch pictures of a lighthouse on a bluff with a sunset in the background. It's like some of them want to do something much more modern and graphic and interesting. And there's enough of them who want to do that that they can support somebody like me. My grandmother would be amazed that I could make a living doing this. So all my patterns start as pencil sketches. That's part of what I love about cross-stitch, is that the actual process, it hasn't changed in hundreds of years. And I have this box full of hundreds of colors of embroidery thread. This is my favorite part of the process, is coming up with the colors. It's a Singer sewing machine that looks like an old Singer sewing machine. It's black and it has this like fun, swoopy gold. It's sort of a perfect icon for my business. It's like hearkening back to an era, a design that's beautiful from an old era, but it's a very modern functional object that works in a way that we want things to work now. It's got computerized fancy features and new fangled stuff that my grandmother would never know how to use. There's enough people out there who still love cross-stitch and still are interested in this ancient craft, that I think is what's so great about the internet revolutionizing craft. Stoli, who's my cross-eyed Siamese cat, and he's kind of like the mascot for Satsuma Street. He's very popular on my Instagram. I learned the hard way that having a job that the rest of the world thinks is glamorous isn't as important as having a job that nobody thinks is glamorous, but that makes you really happy.
We're going to end today with a story about marriage, which is, after all, an economic institution in many ways. Evgeny Filipov and his family are Bulgarian-American, And when his sister Elena got married, Scott, her non-Bulgarian groom, dove into an old and old-fashioned tradition. Here's Evgeny.
A little bit of a disclaimer. My experience with Bulgarian weddings may be a little bit strange. I think it's all regional. Every region might have its own different traditions, and some of them are a little bit outdated, I think. Some of the customs are outdated, but I think that makes it fun. And a lot of the traditions are now more of a joke than anything else. Just to give a little bit of context, is a lot of these traditions come from 200 or 300 years ago. When you do have two families trying to make an arrangement, trying to send off their daughter to join the other family, and they'd like some gifts in return. Sometimes they'd just be so happy that they're marrying away their daughter, and you know, maybe she's going to go to a great family and she's going to have a great life, and they really like each other, so they wouldn't have that much of a bartering. But I think the bartering came about more for the cases where the bride's family wasn't as willing. Those might be those cases where they just don't like the other family, or they just don't like the groom in particular and would want a price. My sister's name is Galina, and her now husband is Scott. He was not initially very familiar with all these customs, and of course we had to lead him in. So the groom and his family came to our house before the actual ceremony. I asked Scott, well, Scott, what are you doing here? Why are you coming here? And he said, oh, well, you know, I've heard this really beautiful girl that I like here and really interested in her, and I think she's the most beautiful Bulgarian girl in the world, and I want to marry her. And I said, oh, okay, that's very interesting. And I said, well, what are you willing to offer? You know, we're not letting together go easy. He talks to his groomsmen. You know, get a little bit of money together. I think they were $60, $70. And I said, oh, okay, that seems fair. And I said, you know, I think we're ready to make this deal. And he said, oh, that seemed pretty easy. So he's got his trump cards ready. Basically, he had one of these really nice rakias for my dad. And he gave him the rakia. He had a nice scotch ready for me. He gives me the scotch. And he thought, you know, the deal was all done. But then I had my aunt there, and she's this, you know, good-looking for her age, but she's about 60. And I said, oh, for the money and everything you've given me, you can have her now. And he was like, wow, this is a little bit not what I expected. You know, I was like, this is what you bargained for. You said the most beautiful Bulgarian girl, and so he can have my aunt. And he's like, well, actually, we were here for, you know, Elena, your sister. I said, oh, well, that's going to cost you a lot more, you know. So we kind of did this playing around, going up a little bit of money. And he's, again, talking with his groomsmen, kind of making it like a show. You know, I mean, we had about 50, 60 people outside in front of our house, kind of doing this show for them. You know, at one point we had her shoe out there. So what I said is, Scott, if you can fill up this shoe with money, then maybe we'll let you have my sister. You know, sure enough, they gathered up enough money, they filled up her shoe, and kind of just changed my mind in the end, said, no, we're not giving her. And then we all ran back in the house, closed the door, and, you know, at this point, they would try to break in. And, you know, after 30, 40 seconds of them pushing the door, we eventually let them in. And at that point, it moves on to a more traditional kind of, you know, we welcome all the guests, we had food ready. The main objective was really to just have kind of this introduction to all of Scott's family of what are some of these old funny traditions that we do. When all these shenanigans were over, basically we ended up at $311 and a bottle of scotch and a bottle of rakia. You might say, well, my sister's could be worth a little bit more than that. I think she was maybe a little bit upset. She might have wanted a little bit more money. But yeah, in the end of the day, $311, and actually we decided that's going to go to their honeymoon and they can take care of that.
That's our show for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Haley Hirschman and Raghu Manavalan, with additional production from Jenny Ahmed. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.